Robert Chapman has a lot of that. He is the owner and editor of the International Forecaster, and we'll see what he has to say about business, finance, economics, and socio-political issues in 2010, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Robert Chapman, it's nice to get to know you here. As we've done this show before, always like to bring in new voices, and especially somebody who has the depth and breadth of experience that you do. How do you describe your resume, Robert?
Very varied and sort of worldwide in nature.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at some of the subjects that you feel comfortable talking about, and it makes me want to go a little bit into some areas that we haven't gone to already tonight, or at least only touched on, like terrorism in 2010, which came up in the first hour, but we really haven't talked about it much and some of the economic implications of that. How comfortable would you be when we're talking about that type of socio-political happenings around the world?
No, relatively so. I think that any event is disrupting. The question is, where does it come from and what's the intent?
Well, because what we see is, you know, for example, I mean, we are putting a lot of investment in Afghanistan, in Iraq. We're hoping that we're going to be able to get something back from that and that there'll be more peace and more stability, and that will lead to, at least in some people's estimation, more security when it comes to oil. Do you anticipate a stable oil economy for 2010?
Well, I think they're looking for a geopolitical platform. I think they'd do a lot better if they were able to subsidize the Afghan drug growers, which is the poppy, and which eventually becomes heroin, and it would give government more credibility. But when you can go on the internet and look at photos of U.S. military personnel wandering around the poppy fields, you kind of wonder, are they running things, or are they guarding it, or are they just visiting it?
Right, yeah. I think we do need a bigger caption, I think, on those photos to explain that. So as we enter into 2010, then, how do you feel about the U.S. dollar? We've heard discussions tonight about how it's going to be faltering in 2010, although not everybody can agree on when or whether or not the government will do more to try to prop it up. What do you see?
Well, I see that government, and particularly the Federal Reserve, which is privately owned, they are in a box, and they have been for a long time. And the ultimate price that has to be paid is either the economy is stabilized by stimulus programs of one form or another, or in that process, if they do support, which they have been, what will happen is that the dollar will go down, and we've seen that. We saw a top last May of 89.5 on the USDX index. That index is six currencies, majors, weighted against the dollar. And so it went down to 74. It's now back up to 78. You might call it a rally. Why are they having the rally? Primarily because there have been problems in other countries, countries such as Dubai.
Right.
And now we had rating drops in Greece. And
right.
We know that they're coming in
Spain.
And Greece is part of the Eurozone.
Right.
As is Spain, Ireland, and Italy. And so the question arises, are any of these countries going to drop out of the euro? And they may very well do so. What's the alternative? Well, the other large currency of the world is the dollar. So the excuse for a dollar rally. I don't think it's going to continue to go about what it's doing on this rally. And the reason why is that the underlying problems of credit crisis and stimulus are still going on.
Do you think we will ever see 89 on the USDX again?
Well, again, it's difficult, but I don't think so. The damage is horrific. I mean, we've got just in the last year, the Fed and the Treasury combined have put debt into the system equaling about close to $13 trillion. And that's a lot of money.
Right.
And credit. And so what they want to do is start drawing it back out and eventually raise interest rates, bringing back normality. And I don't think that's going to happen. I think that the pressure on the dollar is going to continue. They can't take the money back out of the system, because if they do, the deflationary undertow will surmount or overcome the amount of money and credit that they poured into the system.
So how low do you think the dollar could go in 2010?
It's a possibility of 40 to 55.
Wow.
It's hard to say. It depends upon a lot upon events. And we don't know what those events are going to be. But I think on a fundamental basis that it could be easily assumed that 71.18, the former low, would be broken. And I think we could easily see 55 or 60. And if that happens, there's a good chance that there could be an official devaluation of the U.S. dollar over the next year and a half, and that would really disrupt things. But I think it's an inevitability.
So, where was the dollar, if you remember, when we entered into this new millennium? Where were we at 2000? Where at one point we were doing a lot to pay off our debt, and we had a much more balanced economy. Where was the dollar then?
Well, the dollar in regard to the USDX had a high of 124.
In what year?
So it's 74. It's come down a considerable amount over that period of time. The real trouble started about 6.5 years ago. And that's when the U.S. government started pouring money into the system via the Fed. And unfortunately, all the other central banks followed. And so they've been doing the same thing, some to a greater degree, some to a lesser degree. We'll take the euro as an example. It had a high of 12.8, and that 12.8% increase in money and credit was the top. Right now it's around 3.7.
Right.
For the euro. Yeah. We've been averaging for 6.5 years around 14%.
But just look at that then. If you're right and we could see something, let's just say around 50 on the USDX for the dollar sometime in 2010, I mean, that's about half of where we were just 6.5 years ago.
That's correct. And, you know, if you take 50 and go to 100, which is a double, you're looking at probably a 30% reduction in the value of the dollar before the end of the year is out, or at least within the next year and a half. And you have to remember as well that right now 61.8% of all foreign reserves held by foreign countries are held in the form of U.S. dollars. And incidentally, in the last 6 months, that's down from 64.5%. So it shows you that central banks have been dollar sellers. They're anticipating this.
So where does that put you in terms of precious metals?
Well, I think that it's going to be reflected in part in precious metals, but there's two things driving precious metals. The main one is presently a flight to quality. And what has happened is that central banks and other financial professionals in part have lost confidence in the ability of central banks to handle a problem. And when you have a loss of confidence, you have a loss of trust as well. And so they have been going to gold and silver related assets in one form or another in order to hedge any possible problem in the future. You have another school that's not as prominent at the moment, and they think there's going to be inflation. Now, the U.S. government and other governments lie about their inflation all the time. In fact, they lie about all the statistics. And that's why it's very difficult for business to operate in that kind of environment, because they really don't know what's going to happen, because they don't know whether the figures are right. Now, right now, official inflation is about 1.8%. Unofficial inflation is about 8.25%. This is not unusual. Happened 2 years ago. 2 years ago, they said inflation is 5.25%. Real inflation was over 14%. We're going to get that again this year. Most people don't see it yet. When did it start? Last May. Inflation that most people couldn't say got underway. Next year, what will it be? If they continue the programs that they've been doing, it'll probably go over 20%. They're trying, the Fed, is trying to withdraw money from the system. They do that in a number of ways. They just try to remove TARP monies from the system, about $700 billion in total.
You know,
it looks like they've got about $300 billion, and they're moving towards getting more money to withdraw it from the system. The problem is, up pops the Treasury, and they say, look, we need you to buy $200 billion more worth of Treasuries. So there goes $200 billion, if they get the whole $700 billion back.
Right.
And then the president jumps up and says, wait a minute, I need another $500 billion in stimulus. So why don't you give that to me? So there's the Fed standing flat-footed, saying, my goodness, well, that's not going to work for us. What do we do next? And so what they do is they go into the treasury market, and they start selling treasuries that they have, which in turn are absorbed by banks. And either this is called a repo procedure, and it's very complicated. But anyway, they can withdraw money from that system, but they only can withdraw so much. How much? Probably $100 billion.
Okay.
And they want to remove about $1.5 trillion. And so they're having a very hard time doing it. So inflation is coming. It's going to be higher. It's going to be led in the spring, I believe, by inflation for the cost of food, because the supplies of grains and beans that inevitably America has had for years and years is down to the bottom of the barrel. And because of that, they're not going to be able to export as much as they have in the past. You have things going on like in the Central Valley of California, because of some minnow, they stopped giving water to the Central Valley, which is one of the most prolific producers of food in the nation.
Right.
That's adding to the problem. And so I think there's going to be a lot of food inflation. We've seen oil move back up to around $80. Will it go to 100? Maybe. Will it stay there? Probably. Will it go below 70 again? Probably not. And so you have these factors that are going to lead to higher inflation.
We've heard from a couple of people that they thought that oil would stabilize in the upper 60s, but part of that is based on the idea that many of these new energy technologies are going to be coming online in 2010 that we've been investing in, or companies have been investing in over the last couple of years, and it's going to take some of the pressure off of oil. Any signs on that in the international forecaster?
Well, I think that that's fair to say that will help. A diminution of the world economy would help as well, bring prices down. The problem you have major oil companies who are in the market, and they really run the market, and they can make oil whatever they want to make it.
Right.
And so a lot of what you see in oil, which is one of the most manipulated of all markets, not necessarily manipulated by government, but by the major oil companies.
Yeah, and they love to cry. They love to cry poverty too, and talk about how they're always victims of these international situations. But there never seems to be a real cause and effect for when the prices go up, and what they blame the price changes on.
That's an excellent way to put it. So the only conclusion you can come to is that there's an ulterior force which we don't quite understand as common Americans or common people of the world, that only can be explained by experts who suspect that there's manipulation in the oil market. And unfortunately, we have seen that just recently in prices again. How does Goldman Sachs tell us that they know oil's going to be $80 a barrel when it's selling at 60?
Right. Although a lot of people took a bath on Wall Street when they were betting on it going over 200, and then it didn't, and it actually went down. And as I understand it, there's some people that lost out on that futures market.
Big time. It was tremendous losses.
Yeah.
In fact, some of the hedge funds went under because of it.
Because of that.
And they don't necessarily know what's going on.
Well, you know, the indication for me is always this, that when the prices go up, they go up right away. I mean, something happens. There's some story. There's a threat of another hurricane in the Gulf or something. And suddenly the prices spike literally overnight. But then they take a week to come down. So they can always go up really fast. But for some reason, they inch downward every time they spike up. Let me ask you about this then. Could there be upheaval in the Middle East that could affect the production of oil again, either genuinely or artificially driving up the price per barrel?
Well, I think in that case it would be genuine. And the chances of that are 8 out of 10. We've known, it's public knowledge that Israel has over and over again said we want to invade Iran because they're going to have atomic weapons or hydrogen weapons or nuclear weapons, which could destroy us. And so the intelligence that I'm getting out of the Middle East tells me that something bad is going to happen this year. And that would include Iran. And what the thinking is among knowledgeable people in the Middle East is that it's not going to be confined to Iran and to Israel. It is the thinking that any place that there is a U.S. complex, military complex, or any nation which has accommodated or been trained by U.S. military will be attacked. And that would include Dubai and Saudi Arabia and so on. And many very wealthy, connected people in the Middle East who have big investments in that area are leaving, and they think that after the end of February that it's very possible that there may be a conflict. And so I think the chances are extremely strong, and we could be looking at extended conflict in the Middle East.
Well, just like pardon me, this moment of skepticism. Yes, if there was a conflict in the Middle East, it would be a genuine cause on the price of oil to go up. But that's to assume that the conflict is going to be genuine. And if people are forecasting a conflict, could it not be like how Goldman Sachs forecasts an oil change, that people know there's going to be a conflict coming up because they need a conflict coming up? We'll get back to that coming up with Robert Chapman of the International Forecaster and your calls on Coast to Coast. You were talking before about the difference between the real numbers and the reported numbers, right? So inflation might be reported officially at 2.5 or whatever it was, but then unofficially might be more like 8, right?
Correct.
Is it possible that if the Dow drops from where it is roughly right now, 10.4, down to, say, into the 8,000 mark, that would actually be better for our economy in 2010 if it were an authentic 8,500 as opposed to a propped-up 10.4?
I think it would be. I think it would make people think more deeply. I think it might push lenders to lend. Lenders are not lending. They've dropped their year-to-year lending to about by about 18%. And right now, it's almost impossible to get a loan.
Especially if you're a small business, a small to medium-sized business.
Well, that's 90% of what they lend is to those companies as well as individuals. And if you can believe this, they're asking for 50% collateralization in cash. So if you go in and ask for a $100,000 loan, they want you to have a compensating balance of $50,000 plus other collateral as well. Well, most companies can't do that.
Right.
And so there's virtually no lending going on.
That virtually guarantees that they're not risking anything. And what we need, in fact, is we need them to loan money so that these small businesses can expand to become medium businesses. The medium businesses can expand to become large businesses. They hire more people. They start giving out real jobs. And they use up some of this commercial real estate.
70 to 90% of the people who are hired by small companies. And so what you're having here is strangulation. How can the economy expand when you've got those kind of rules going on? And who do most of the helping of money and credit, who did it go to? It went to the very lenders that caused the problem in the first place.
Yeah, that's a whole nother show. Let's go to Roy, first-time caller line in North Carolina on Coast to Coast for Robert Chapman.
Hi, guys. Great info. But I feel the elephant in the room is that Americans have come to hate and despise good fundamental labor, and hence even the good fundamental laborers. We have nearly killed the entire means of production. You know, we've killed our manufacturing, our big manufacturing, almost all, even the steel industry. And America occupies the virtual paradise of Earth, the temperate zone, with all raw materials. I feel this started like 30 years ago with Ronald Wilson Reagan, 666, raising payroll taxes outrageously. We've squeezed farmers, construction workers down to the bare bones.
Well, I don't know about the let's put the Reagan thing off the table for the moment and say, what about this? What if it, and Robert, I'd be curious to see what your reaction is to this. I've heard some people say that the reason why we've lost our labor force and why factories began to close and why we still have jobs that go unfilled is that there was a shift mid-20th century into a belief that there was something shameful about trade schools, that everybody had to go to college, when college really isn't meant for everybody. And for that matter, that we started, you know, we began to look down our nose at good, clean labor like, you know, plumbers, electricians, construction workers. And we began to think of that as unskilled or something that was below our children, something to be ashamed of. And that there's something that we are still recovering from that idea. Nobody gives birth to a child and says, I hope he grows up to be a tradesman, when that may be just exactly what that kid would be great at and just what society needs.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And that was the salvation of part of any population, was to have that group of people who could create things. And, yes, we've been going away from that. Everybody has to go to college. My feeling is more than half of the people in college don't belong there.
Right.
And if you notice, historically, we can go back 50 years, that approximately, depending upon the university, about 45 to 50% of freshmen graduate. And that's not very good. And there's a lot of reasons why. But I think the biggest reason for the problems of manufacturing, and that is a factor, but the biggest reason is free trade, globalization, offshoring, and outsourcing. That's where the real problem has come in. And it's very, very profitable for transnational corporations to take factory A out of the United States and hire somebody in China to do the work. And the profits that they get from the export of those products back to the United States and Europe go into an offshore account, and they don't pay any taxes on them. So it's win-win for the manufacturers. So something has to be constructed to stop that, and it's called tariffs on goods and services, and that's a solution.
All right. Let's get to Joan in Anchorage, Alaska, on Coast to Coast for Robert Chapman. Joan?
Hello, Ian and Robert. I want to know what you feel about terrorism in the Ukraine, because I have an idea on it, how to correct it and stop it.
Terrorism, did you say?
Terrorism, yes.
Not well, tourism, terrorism.
I think very quickly, I think you should give us your idea.
Well, I don't know if I should say it over the phone to write influence the enemy.
Well, that'll be your choice, Joan. What will you choose?
Because I'd love to hear it, because any kind of solution's good. Because I don't think many of us have solutions, so...
Go ahead, Joan. I'll make it short here. If you don't want to, I'll be happy to move on. You tell me.
The idea is to warn the people that the next time there's any terrorism, we're going to retaliate by eliminating all the mosques each time.
Eliminating what? I'm sorry, mosques?
Yeah, the mosques.
Who would you? What kind of mosques would you choose?
The first one would be the one that they all bow down to.
Okay. Doesn't that put us into the realm of terrorists ourselves? Anytime we go after the innocent in the name of the guilty, aren't we creating more injustice?
No one would be killed.
Okay. Robert Chapman, you're the international forecaster. Would that work?
I don't think so. I don't. I think those kind of things just inflame even more the opposition. The opposition is there because we're occupying their countries, and that's the main reason.
Well, I can't imagine that in the reverse if they decided to knock out a church or a cathedral because a Christian did something that they didn't like, how she would feel about that. But let's get to Dan in Portland in the time that we have left. One of our last callers tonight on Coast to Coast for our annual prediction show, but this time from the professionals, the economists. Say, Dan.
Good evening, gentlemen and Coast listeners. Thank you for adding to the dialogue of my life. The reason why I called and what I told the screener, I don't know her name, it wasn't Tom, it was the female, was I wanted to talk about believing hard, but before I ask my question, I would like to make a statement about services. I mean, if you look at like what the last caller talked about is terrorism and mosques and stuff, and I don't want to go there because people can believe whatever they believe. Hopefully they don't believe too hard. But what in America happens is because of terrorism, there is an economy that's a service economy. And maybe in the financial system, really what the financial system does is they provide services. And if the level of services that aren't controlled by the financial system are provided by somebody else, then I mean maybe that's why the bubble popped. And I guess my question for Robert is, and I don't know if you use software to do your forecasting, but I think if you did, and you know, how much weight in the algorithm is attributed to believing hard and the services that are capable of being provided to that level of believing hard, whatever that is. I don't know, gentlemen, it's late at night.
Yeah, I'm not sure I quite follow. Let's see if Robert follows that. Robert?
No, I don't, but I will say this, that computers, especially those that do quantitative analysis, have been proven to be faulty over and over again. We saw that in the late 90s with the Scholes and his partner who had received Nobel Prizes, they went bankrupt. And so there are big gaping holes in what you can accomplish through what they call black box approach. And there's always that element of chance that you can't figure on. It's like the man who goes to the roulette table and has a system, and the system doesn't work. It's very similar to that. And so I do look at it, but and I do look at charts as well, and waves and cycles of the past. But I'm basically a fundamentalist because you can't argue with it. It's there, it happened, or is happening, and you can figure out where it's going to go based upon history. And so I tend to look at that more strongly than anything else.
All right, let's get to Mark in Vancouver. Our time is running out for Robert Chapman. Go ahead, Mark.
Yes, Robert. I have a two-part question for you. As you know, it was Sunday, April 5th, 1933, when FDR ordered the bank holiday. Do you think Obama will follow the international bankers' lead and order a bank holiday on April 4th, 2010, marking a 77-year anniversary? And what might precipitate a bank holiday?
Well, let me ask you, where did you come up with that? Why that date do you believe the international bankers are calling for that? Where do you get that?
Well, a lot of the bankers and the elitists are into numerology. 77-year anniversary of the bank holiday that FDR ordered with the Federal Reserve and the Secretary of Treasury in the White House on Sunday morning will be April 4th, 2010.
So you're saying that they have made some sort of announcement that this is something that they want
to
do?
No, I just wonder if Obama will Obama, being the president, will take his marching orders from the international bankers when it's time to call the bank holiday, just like FDR did in 1933.
Okay.
I think that the president will take marching orders anytime he's given them. As far as a repetition in April of this year, possible but not probable. I think that they have to go further with the situation because they're going to be under tremendous pressure from a dollar that's under tremendous pressure. And so you also have to look at the climate among people during the two periods of time. In the 1930s, people walked around with $5 and $10 gold pieces in their pocket. Many, many, many people, probably more than half the population, walked around with gold in their pocket. They don't do that today. Less than 3%, and maybe, because we're guessing, maybe less than 1% or 2% of Americans own gold. And so I don't think it's worthwhile for government to say we're going to confiscate your gold. And you've got to remember that in the 30s, only 25% of the people turn their gold in spite of the fact, in today's dollars, the fine was $1 million and 10 years in jail. And so I think I don't think they're going to do that because it's not worthwhile for them to do it.
You know, you're messing with a lot of people's worldviews, not mine, but there's a lot of people that are really invested in this idea, apparently, that President Obama is going to come for their gold in 2010, and that you say it's unlikely to happen or that there's no real incentive to have it. And I think it's interesting that you said how many people were walking around with gold back in the 30s as opposed to today. And I think that actually there's a lot of paranoia about this gold and how much, what are they going to have to do not only to get it but then to protect it?
Well, there would be far more chance that they probably, through the United Nations, would try to confiscate weapons. That is a real problem for them. Gold is not a problem for them.
Let's get to Fred on a wild card line in Davison, Michigan, for Robert Chapman. Last call. Go ahead, Fred.
Okay, thanks. I'm into solutions, Ian. Okay. I call it Grassroots Inform Nation Project, based on the fact that the Federal Reserve, being the infamous foreign private corporation, which is one of the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto, violates the Federal Charter's provision of a gold and silver-based monetary system. So why not reestablish issuing U.S. Treasury notes backed by gold and silver coin, or at least, as JFK had begun to do, the Treasury notes. I think silver was still in circulation at the time. Secondly, Ian, George interviewed a Tom Crier back around July, truthattack.org. He's launched the Tea Party Square movement. And at Tea Party or truthattack.org, there's a 110-page memorandum of law that is the blueprint for unshackling all Americans from the fraudulent income tax. And Tom Crier is a tax attorney.
Do you have a question for our guest, Fred?
Yes.
Okay, so, good. In the time we have, go ahead.
What do you say relative to what I just mentioned as a blueprint for restoring American sovereignty, since it's obvious Congress is not going to honor Ron Paul's H.R. 1207?
Go ahead.
Well, I think that if Congress passes it, they'll have to honor it. And I think the exposure, what the Fed has been doing, will bring about its demise very quickly. But as far as going back to sound money, we'll call it that, you're absolutely correct. And it would turn America down. But I think the gaping hole is, do they have any gold? We don't know. We know that gold is in Fort Knox. And I know that because I have a subscriber who used to work there. He was in the military. So there's gold there, but we don't know whether it's gold-covered tungsten bars or who it belongs to or why don't they have an audit. But if they do have the gold and we could revert to what you just described as sound money, that would work and it would turn the country around. And it would do away with the Fed, and the power would go back to the Treasury where it emanated from the first place from the Constitution.
There you go. And Robert Chapman, nice way to end. Appreciate that. And looking forward to 2010. I'm looking forward to getting my voice back sometime in 2010, too. I hope you feel better. Thank you, Rob. I hear you sneezing occasionally in the background. And enjoy a happy and healthy new year.